Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have something special in store for you. We're going to talk about, well, something that is in the news these days, to say the least. And yeah, there are medical ramifications to it. This is a health show, and from time to time, we've got to face it, there are big changes coming down the pike in terms of healthcare in this country, and it's about politics, and it's about government, and it's about your right to healthcare of your choice. And of course, we're talking about Obamacare. And some people take issue with me when I use the term Obamacare. They say it's not respectful, it's disparaging. We should use the actual term for the health reform bill, which is the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or even more unwieldy, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, PPACA, if you will. But it's much more convenient to say Obamacare, and even the president himself says, I'll take it on, I'll take responsibility for it, because he views Obamacare as one of his signature accomplishments as president. So today's guest is an advocate and an activist on the healthcare front. She's Twyla Braze, and she's president of the Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We're going to find out in just a few moments what that's all about. So in terms of her background, she is a registered, a certified public health nurse, and she provides commentary for Health Freedom Minute. She provides testimony at state legislatures and meets with members of Congress, and she speaks all over the country, and she's kind of hot on the talk show circuit. She's been on CNN and Fox News and NBC Today Show, and her quotes are appearing in major publications like the Associated Press, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and other places. So she certainly has her finger on the pulse of politics in Washington and across the country when it comes to healthcare, and she's an advocate for healthcare freedom. So welcome to the program, Twyla. It's nice having you as a guest here on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so first of all, tell us about the mission statement for the Citizens Council for Health Freedom.
Well, we have that statement, and our little slogan is ensuring health freedom for all. We have that because of the importance of freedom for a patient to get the kind of medical care and attention that they need without being interrupted or being restricted by outsiders who have other agendas and other initiatives in mind. And so we have, you know, our whole goal is to support patient and doctor freedom, to support medical innovation, and to support the individual's right to a confidential patient-doctor relationship, a relationship where they can trust what they say is held confidential, where they can trust what they receive from that doctor is what that they as a patient need personally for themselves as customized, individualized care without, you know, outsiders, you know, deciding that using different protocols and using different mechanisms and different payment strategies to restrict access to care or to ration care.
And obviously you see some of the new healthcare legislation is threatening that doctor-patient relationship and threatening patient confidentiality. Can you give us some specifics on how patient privacy might be invaded by the advent and implementation of the Obamacare rules?
Well, I think that there are so many ways. Actually, we have online a brochure that lists just 10 of the different ways that privacy is going to be impacted negatively as a result of the law. So we can look at several things. We can look at the fact that the government is now going to require you to report your insurance status. There are other provisions where the employer is going to be able to get federal funds if they do prevention and wellness programs, and then they have to report back to the federal government on whether there has been improvement in those who have participated.
Just to interrupt, I mean, that sounds like a good proposal because we want all Americans to be healthier, we want them to stop smoking, we want them to eat well, we want them to exercise, and so on. So how can we go wrong with that kind of proposal?
Well, I think, you know, it's one thing you mentioned the word we. We want all Americans. Well, all Americans are responsible for themselves. if the government comes in with a law or even your employer comes in and tries to dictate your behavior, tries to monitor your behavior, tries to make sure that you eat right, you know, then we do not have freedom. Freedom is about being able to make personal decisions and have personal consequences as a result of those decisions, and to learn in the process and maybe make different decisions in the future. But the idea that outsiders would track our behavior, track our decisions, track our weight, track our eating, track our exercising, track all of those sorts of things, and then report to the federal government or give us scorecards as to how well we're doing, this is not freedom. This is outsiders determining what healthy behavior is and then trying to dictate that for the American public.
Right. So also there's going to be a proliferation of information systems. And we know that, these information systems, they're supposed to be encrypted, super secure, but then somebody leaves a laptop in a car and the car's broken into, and then 20 million social security numbers suddenly are released to international criminals on the internet. What are some of the implications of the centralization of information, information exchange, and sharing with government agencies that Obamacare will imply?
Right. Well, the central feature of Obamacare is a structure called the exchange. And a lot of people talk about the federal exchange or different states state exchanges, but I like to say what this is a national exchange. And the exchange is a nationwide computerized network to share information between websites that individuals go to and state agencies and federal government agencies and health plans. And so this will be a massive amount of data sharing. And if you don't understand an exchange, the best way to understand it is to try and envision it like perhaps a spider. So the body of the spider is called the Federal Data Services Hub. And then consider this spider to have 50 arms, one for every state. And that's the electronic network that reaches down into the state. And at the state level is what I like to call a dummy terminal. So if you're considering this as a big computerized system, the dummy terminals are where people go to provide their information to see if they are eligible for Obamacare, for this new government health care program, or for the new federal subsidies to help pay for the cost of it. And so this is a huge data gathering machine, but it's one exchange. So one central server called the Federal Data Services Hub and 50 dummy terminals gathering information, one in each state. Now, in California, that dummy terminal, that exchange, is called Covered California. In Connecticut, it's called Health Access CT. In Minnesota, it's called MinSure. But all together, they're all the same, and they're just a place to gather the information, to share the information with the Federal Data Services Hub. Now, what the hub does, as soon as you press send of your data to the hub then goes back through the network and goes into the state agencies to find information on you to see if it agrees with what you provided to them on the website. It also goes into the federal agencies to look at things like your social security number, your criminal status, your tax status, your citizenship status. And then all of this information that is gathered from you at your terminal that you're sitting there at your website, and from the state agencies and from the federal agencies as well as from health plans, all of this goes into a new federal database called the Health Insurance Exchange Program.
Well, stop right there. You know, a lot of people would say, well, you know, this is progress. You know, this is the price we pay for progress. I mean, as long as I'm not doing anything wrong, as long as I'm not a criminal, or I'm not doing anything bad, you know, the government, isn't going to do anything with this information. And what do I have to hide, really? I mean, you know, you go to a hospital and, you know, you've got medical records and they sit on shelves and, you know, who knows who's going to look at those anyway. It's all the information's out there.
Well, all the information is not out there, otherwise we would have had this database before, but this is a brand new database, and it's considered the largest one to be created in the country, and it is. There are several reasons why people should think twice about it. One, it allows every person in the population to be profiled. It is a tracking system for your insurance status. There are all sorts of people, and whether they're insured or not, or whether they use a health sharing organization or whatever their classification is. Lots of people, the federal government, has no idea today. But once this system gets set up, it will have an idea. And this is how the IRS will enforce the mandate that everybody purchase health insurance, no matter if it feels quite unaffordable to you, no matter if it's against your conscience, providing services that are objectionable to you, no matter what the reasons are.
Well, let's look at a couple of conceivable scenarios. You know, there's a lot of debate about the Second Amendment these days and the right to bear arms. And then, of course, there have been terrible acts of violence where people with mental disorders have shot up schools and shot up public events. And so it's been proposed that we better screen for mental disorders before we allow people to have guns. But it's now estimated that a very high percentage of Americans take various types of psychiatric medications. I mean, say, you know, you're having a bad time, you decide to see a psychiatrist, you're given a prescription for an anti-anxiety medication or perhaps an antidepressant, and that's on your record. And then you apply for a gun. Is it conceivable that that could be an obstacle to your rightful possession of a firearm if you're, you know, a legal law-abiding citizen who once had a bout with depression?
Well, that is true, but just to be clear, it does not seem quite at this point that that kind of information is going to be in this database. But as you know, perhaps once you create a database and you start connecting it to all sorts of agencies in the federal government, the idea of connecting it to a new agency or a new system of information is highly possible. Then, of course, we have to look at what's happening now with the NSA and all sorts of things that have been said previously and are now we're finding out. We don't know what the federal government will decide to do once they have this information. Plus, it's not only the federal government, and this is one of the concerns, is that the government is putting together a whole host of new government workers called navigators.
Right.
And those navigators will be available to help people enroll in the government exchange for government coverage. And all, just so you know, all coverage in the exchange is government coverage. There's no private insurance. It may say Blue Cross Blue Shield on it, but you are applying to the federal government under penalty of perjury. And so this is all a government program. There's no private insurance, no matter what they say. And so you have these navigators, and the navigators, Walgreens and CVS Pharmacy, have decided that they are going to let navigators come into their pharmacies and try and enroll people through the pharmacy.
Why not?
They will have access to the information.
They'll sell more drugs that way. You know, more people are signed on, more people will be eligible to get reimbursement for medications, and the pharmacies will, you know, be able to fulfill more prescriptions. But so you're saying these navigators, but what's the qualification to become a navigator? You know, do they have any kind of investigation or any kind of background check before these people who are going to be entrusted with this important and confidential information get access to it?
Well, we understand that there are no background checks, and what there are or what there is a course, an online course, and then there is a certification, a test essentially required. Through, no matter how you get this course, you can get it online, or there can be organizations that choose to teach it, but no matter what, you have to go to the federal government or to the state exchange, however it's going to be run in each state. You have to go and then test through that way, but that has been one of the contentions, is that there are no criminal background checks for the navigators. Now, they may change their mind after this becomes more controversial and becomes more well-known, but at least that's where we understand it is at this point.
Yeah, and I worry about the implications for people who have perhaps embarrassing medical conditions, say, you know, a sexually transmitted disease, and they might consider going to the field of politics, or maybe this is information that could be divulged to a prospective spouse or a current spouse through misuse or mishandling of the information. Is that a conceivable scenario from the privacy standpoint?
Well, just to be clear, at this point, the Health Insurance Exchange and the Federal Data Services Hub and the new central database are not planning to gather medical record information except for three items. One of them is pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Another one is disability. And the third one, Oh, I can't remember the third one. Sorry about that. But there are just three items. But that doesn't mean that in the future, healthcare won't be wrapped up into it. And furthermore, the exchanges say what they're going to do is they're going to provide information on the so-called quality of your doctor or the quality of your hospital, which means that the government will measure according to their own standards, which might include not providing certain care that they consider medically unnecessary. But that's beside the point. What this all means is that the government is going to take data from medical records on doctors, and they're going to put out this scorecard on the exchange whether or not it's actually true. I mean, as a patient, if you actually looked at what the quality measurements were, you might go, well, what does that have to do with anything?
You mean like a report card for doctors?
Right, and hospitals. And so, you know, if a physician has only 90% or has only 80% of the patients vaccinated, well, is that bad or is that good? Because what if his
patient I don't think I would score very well on by that criterion.
They don't want to.
Right.
Yeah. And so then the doctor is scored badly when actually he's a quality physician.
Right.
What if he gives personal, individualized care, but it's outside the government protocols? He's scored badly.
Right. For example, I think I would score very badly because I don't prescribe the right antihypertensive medications when patients come to see me. I don't prescribe enough diabetes medications when people have blood sugar problems. I don't prescribe enough antibiotics when people come in with mild to moderate infections. You know, we try to use a natural therapy. Is there some kind of allocation for physicians who do it differently? Maybe the alternative medicine community?
Not to my knowledge. There's a list of measurements, and every physician is measured according to those measurements. I have never heard or seen anything that says a more alternative medicine measurement versus, a regular allopathic medicine.
Right. I don't think there is such a provision. Recently there were some dramatic developments. Yesterday, Congress acted before going on vacation in a dramatic way. The House passed a bill. Can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, the House passed that bill today.
Okay.
And you're right. Sorry.
For our podcast audience, some people may not be listening.
Depends on when you're listening.
Right.
Yes. So on Friday, the House passed a bill to say that the IRS cannot enforce Obamacare. And four Democrats joined all the Republicans. And that means that the bill passed, but it will be very difficult to get that bill through the Senate. Yet what it says is there's consternation on the part of the Republicans and indeed on some Democrats that were brave enough to vote yes with the Republicans and perhaps with other Democrats who were not brave enough or didn't feel they had to within their communities. But the angst, of course, is over the IRS and what it has done to conservative groups to keep them out of being able to form into nonprofit organizations and being able to secure donations, tax-deductible donations, and all of this that has happened, as well as how they have said that they didn't, and now we're actually finding out that they did. And so I think just the fact that the IRS is going to have access to all this data and be the enforcement arm of Obamacare has a lot of people nervous. And
I think we have had so many examples of this. You know, we recently convicted that, Army private, his name? And, you know, he was a very low-level guy, and basically he was like, shuffling numbers and computer files. And yet he had access to the most incredible information. Then we had Snowden, who was, a guy, contract consultant, for a security firm, and he had access to the most unbelievable secrets. And so how can we say that this information is truly secure? You know, we're going to have hundreds of thousands of people working in the vaults of these security administrations trying to keep track of records. And, you know, who's to say that, you know, we've got fail-safe measures in terms of access to very, very sensitive information? I mean, if I were to be treated for, a drug problem or a mental problem or a problem related to sexuality, you know, these are all very delicate issues. And if these issues were to be divulged, you'll say, you know, and we've seen it. I mean, we've seen it with, what's her name, McDonnell, whatever her name was, the gal around for the Senate in Maryland. She had some kind of predicament with real estate, which turned out not to be true, and yet they somehow, the state got to access her, her records, and they put it out there that she was a deadbeat, and that compromised her campaign. And it was stuff that wasn't, it was IRS records related to some kind of mortgage transaction, and somehow that got out because, you know, overzealous political operatives wanted the information out there.
Well, I think what we have come to see with the IRS is that it's become politicized. Now, not all the workers, but clearly the leadership has become politicized. And then I don't know if you heard, but I think it was last week in a hearing with the U.S. Treasury Department, the only one testifying, and the chairman of the committee said, you know, you gave us 500 pages, but it's really nothing. And where are all the emails? Don't you all, you know, talk in mm-hmm. emails? Don't you email each other? And so he actually called her a worthless witness and said that he may subpoena the department in order to try to get the record of what has really happened that they are not talking about. And they're claiming for confidentiality purposes that they can't talk about it, but this is Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Those things can come behind closed doors if need be, but Congress is saying you haven't given us anything.
Well, you know, just to offer a little different perspective on this, I had lunch today with a relative of mine who is a staunch Democrat, a liberal Democrat. And, you know, we got talking, obviously, about politics and Obamacare. And I told her about the interview that I was going to do today. And she said, well, you know, if you're not, you know, a supporter of Obamacare, you know, what are we going to do about all these people who don't have access to health care and health insurance? And she was telling me about a person that she knows who ended up in the hospital for 2.5 days. And they don't have health insurance. I mean, their immigration status is a little bit screwed up. But they're sort of falling between the cracks. And they're presented with a $25,000 bill. And, you know, it's a terrible state of affairs. So, you know, people are going to call the Republicans obstructionists or uncompassionate because they don't have an alternative plan to offer to deal with this. It's still a problem, you know, regardless of whether we repeal or pass Obamacare?
Well, I guess I would say several things. One, because the government has gotten involved and because we have moved away from true insurance for the catastrophes, because that's, after all, what insurance is for. It's not for paying for, you know, the sniffly nose of your
right.
child. It's not for paying for sinus infections. It's for catastrophes.
Exactly. If I may offer an analogy, I mean, it's like if somebody breaks a window in my car, I'm not going to go to the insurance company because I know what's going to happen. They're going to raise my – so I just like – I'll shell out the $200 or the $300 and, you know, I'm not – but if my car gets totaled, that's what the insurance is for, you know.
That's right. And so we have moved away from insurance and we have moved to third party financing of every healthcare expense. And that is very, very expensive. So we have made health insurance unaffordable. And while we have done that, we have also made medical care less affordable, because if the doctors and the nurses have to do all this paperwork, and if they are required to create electronic medical records, and if they have to do all the filing for every little thing through your insurance company, and they have to refile it because they missed the coding, a bill code, right?
And pay huge malpractice premiums on top of it, right?
And so this makes it very unaffordable, even to go in for the simplest of things. But you can see what the potential future is. And you can see that the prices of today do not have to be the prices of tomorrow when you look at the cash for care doctors. So when you look at the doctors who are actually providing healthcare services for cash, not doing insurance, not doing Medicare, not doing Medicaid, not doing all that paperwork, then you can see prices like was reported on CNN, where this one doctor does a
she was
cholesterol.
Up in Maine, I think, right? Yeah, I think she was.
I think he is, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he does a cholesterol level for $3, whereas mm-hmm. if it was done through the insurance company, it would be $90.
Right.
And this just shows you that people are so afraid of the prices of today, mm-hmm. but they don't have to be if they can see through to the prices of tomorrow, if they would just go back to real insurance. and get all the doctors and the nurses out of the bureaucracy, out of the paperwork, and let them concentrate on patient care at an affordable level.
And there's also this issue of moral hazard, too, because, I mean, part of the conversation was this very same relative. She's a little older, and she had, very, very severe dizzy spell. They called 911, the ambulance came, they took her to the hospital, and she says, several months later she got the bill. And I said, she said, I couldn't believe the bill. I said, how much was it? She said, it was almost $11,000. I said, I was only in the hospital for overnight. And I said, oh, how much did it cost you? And she said, well, nothing, of course. And so moral hazard, I mean, look, clearly we can't attribute every illness to some sort of moral deficit or some lifestyle failing. But when we very highly subsidize unhealthy people with unhealthy lifestyles to the same tune as people who follow very healthy lifestyles, it's an inequitable system.
Right. Well, one thing that I like to say is that, if people had to pay, it's like if you took me out for dinner, let's just say, and you said, buy whatever you want. You are sitting across the table from me, and I am going to think about whatever I want is going to mean, and
right.
how it's going to feel when I say that thing to you, and you look down and you see what it costs, right?
Right. Right.
But when the government or when the health plan is saying, whatever, we're covering everything, well, then there's absolutely nothing to make you, and it's so far away. They're in an office, they're in D.C. It's so far away. There's nothing to make you think, well, what would I do if I was paying my own money? I think I would just stay home and see if I get worse. If I get worse, I'll go in, because then I know I really have to go in. But
yeah.
I'm not paying for it, so who cares? I'll just go in.
Yeah, I mean, there are pros and cons to that, because sometimes people who can't afford care, they, to their detriment, they stay away from doctors, and then they wind up in the emergency room when it's too late. But there's another mechanism by which they're going to shave costs. And I think that this is really one of the most insidious parts of Obamacare, and one of the parts that most worries me. And it's something called IPAB. Mm-hmm. You're well aware what that is. In England, they've got something called NICE. That's a very nice acronym. NICE isn't so nice, because it's basically a way that they can ration health care over there. And there are a lot of people, academics and medical experts here, who really admire the British system. They say, this is great, because they've got a system. The people over there love it. So many of the people I've talked to from England don't love it, but, nonetheless, it takes care of a lot of people. So we're going to try to emulate them. We're going to set up something called IPAB. So give us a preview of what that's going to be like.
Well, it's good to understand what IPAB is. The Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, is set up as an institution of 15 political appointees almost outside of the control of Congress. They are set up to make decisions about what will be paid for in Medicare, or if something will or will not be paid for in Medicare, and at what price. And their decision rules the day unless Congress can come up with a supermajority vote to veto it. And it's very difficult for Congress to ever come up with a supermajority vote for anything. And so what it really means is that this institution of 15 individuals, political appointees, they've not been elected, right? They are going to be making decisions about who gets cared for and who doesn't, and who gets paid and who doesn't, and Congress will almost be unable to stop them. It has been called not only unconstitutional, but anti-constitutional. The law even says that after a certain point of time, if Congress has not repealed IPAB and gotten rid of it, Congress can never repeal IPAB. Well,
that's a very interesting part of the law. Is I've never seen a law that says if this is a law that is unrepealable. And, I mean, that part of the legislation is, it's sort of immemorialized in the language. It's very, very strange.
But it's unconstitutional to say that.
Yeah.
And so you cannot tell another Congress coming into the future what they can and cannot do. They can get rid of any law that they want to. So just the fact that they put those words in there as though they could stand, they can't stand.
Well, we'll have to pass the bill to find out what's really in it. And now we're beginning to find out in the immortal words of Nancy Pelosi. Okay, so the concern I have with IPAB is that these individuals, these sage individuals who are going to be completely intellectually honest and dispassionate, will be subject to all kinds of tugs and pulls because nobody in this country is not assailed by influence, by lobbyists. And so, for example, let's take as a premise that there's too much knee surgery in this country, which there is. It's very expensive and we have to curb it. Sometimes it's great, but sometimes it's truly a waste of time and it's a ripoff of the government and it costs a lot of money and we need to shave dollars, so let's do less knee surgery. But let's say a very powerful organization like the orthopedists, you know, it's a large group of doctors, hires a lobbyist, which they have already in place, and the lobbyist says, let me meet with the IPAB members and we'll argue our case. Isn't there going to be all kinds of influence peddling and jockeying and basically lobbying for certain procedures and certain drugs to be included on the formulary and, you know, not taken away?
There will be no end to lobbying. These people will be assailed by everyone who realizes the potential power of their vote in every decision that they make. Now, IPAB has limited times that they can act. Medicare has to be at a certain financial instability before they are required to act. But it won't take too long before Medicare is there all the time because Medicare is now has over a $40 trillion unfunded liability. So, you know, in not too long here, they are by law supposed to start acting to try to curb medication, to try to curb, you know, treatments, to try to curb access of all sorts by cutting costs. By cutting payments.
Right. And in effect, rationing, making decisions about, you know, is this care appropriate for you? Is this care not appropriate for you?
Well, and can I just say, the other thing is that they're not making a decision about whether care is appropriate for you.
Right, overall.
They don't have
yes.
any idea who you are.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
One thing that we like to say. I did a report against evidence-based medicine using all these peer-reviewed papers from
yes.
all these different researchers who just said, you know, we are not alike. You know,
yes.
maybe 80% of us might do well with the same treatment, but there's
yes.
about 20% where you've really got to specialize it. Right?
And in fact, there was, and I think you're an observer of the medical scene. We saw a paper come out, I think it was last week, which reports basically that the majority of medical procedures that we believe are efficacious turn out not to be efficacious. And there's a small minority that are substantiated and turn out to be okay, but then there's a gray zone of about 50% where we're really not sure that what we're doing is in 10 years going to be obsolete or is we're going to have to reverse course on. So to try and set up some kind of monolithic policy goals for all Americans based on, quote, best practices, that's very, very daunting.
Right. Right. Well, and it's just wrong. Because medicine is about a doctor taking care of an individual. It's about the individual being responsible for paying the doctor and therefore really feeling the impact of the decisions that the doctor decides. So if the doctor says, you know, I think you should have XYZ, the patient who's paying it on their own is going to say, well, how much will XYZ cost? And what about if I wait until next year? You know, and these kind of questions will come up, and that will drive the cost of healthcare down. It will also drive out some of the unnecessary medicine because people will not be clamoring for it because they will be looking at their own dollars like they make decisions about every other thing that they buy, and they will be thinking, you know, can I wait? Do I need it now? Is it essential or is it, you know, not? Will it really work? We don't really know if it'll work. Well, then I don't know if I want it done to me. Right? So the problem here is that we have third-party payment for everything, and nobody is thinking the way they think about everything else in their life. And I was just going to say one other thing, because you mentioned it before. You mentioned about talking to that woman friend of yours. And
yes.
said, what about
yep.
all those people?
Yep.
Well, what I like to say
yeah, what
is,
about the indigent? You know, and truly, there are people who are really underserved in this system, and it's terrible. You know, they're left without any kind, I mean, or they're either not going to get the right kind of care or they're just going to go into bankruptcy trying to get their care?
Well, several things I would say. The indigent are not going to sign up for Medicaid or anything else. The indigent will always be with us, and they're not going to bother with the paperwork. They're just going to walk in.
They'll be at the margins, yeah. And, yeah. And frankly, societies have disorganized individuals. I mean, they're really
right.
And one of the reasons maybe, you know, and it's not always a merit system, but sometimes the very people who are at the lowest rung of the economic ladder are people who are disorganized in terms of their health planning.
Or they just don't want to be part of the system. And they'll come in when they have to, but there's no way that they want to provide all that data. They don't have a regular place to live. They don't plan on having a checking account. You know, they don't fit the regular thing, and they're not going to fit it even under Obamacare. And so there are those folks. But the other thing that I would say is there is a lot of money, I would say, being lost on covering all sorts of people who don't actually need access to care. So if you're really going to be talking about taking care of people when they have their needs, then take care of them when they get sick or take care of them when they're injured. But, you know, the health plans, this is where they get the majority of their profit, is by the fact that the government or the state or the federal government is paying them for all these people to be covered. Just covered. But covered is what all these folks are going to realize in short order does not mean that they have access to care. As you probably know, there's going to be a physician shortage.
Yep.
And Obamacare is not helping this because
right.
It is the government taking control of the physicians, and they're not happy about it, and they don't have to practice medicine. They can go leave and get another profession or go and retire.
Right, and
so
this is, I mean, clearly this is affecting a lot of the career decisions of doctors, you know, my age, because I'm, you know, a little bit towards the back nine of my professional career, and a lot of doctors are saying there's so many changes coming down the pike, it's such a hassle, it's no fun anymore, I have to see more patients, they're cutting my reimbursements, I think I'm just going to work less hours, and, you know, I'll take retirement a few years earlier.
Right, and so now we have 30 million more people, supposedly, who are going to be covered under Obamacare through the exchanges and through the expansion of Medicaid, and they're going to have a piece of paper, and it's going to be called coverage.
Right.
But when they want access to care, when they want a doctor, will they be able to get one?
Yeah.
Will they, you know, there's no guarantee of access here. There's just a promise of coverage without a guarantee of access. So we always say coverage is not care. And if you really want to take care of the people who are truly needy, then care for the people who truly have needs. Don't just cover them.
Right. Well, okay, so clearly, I mean, it's almost, I don't think a day goes by that we don't see yet another problem with the ACA or Obamacare. I mean, for example, all these exemptions, you know, we're seeing that the very IRS that is entrusted with implementing Obamacare is requesting an exemption from the provisions of Obamacare. And, you know, just headline after headline. So now I once got up in a meeting and there was this hot mirror. Everybody was discussing the flaws of Obamacare. And I stood up and I said, look, I have a feeling that some of the people who pushed this said, look, whatever, the law, let's pass this thing. Let's just push the ball down towards the goal line. This is not necessarily what we want, but this is what we can get in 2010 or whenever, 2009, when this was passed. And sure, there'll be problems. And this is probably not going to work, but it's going to push us inexorably towards what we really want. Is we really want socialized medicine in this country. We want a system like Scandinavia or Great Britain. And do you see that as potentially the agenda? Because there's so many flaws with this current setup that it's not likely to succeed.
I think it is the agenda. I don't know exactly how they expect or want it to play out, but I do believe that the health insurance exchange is the apparatus for national health care, and they, I think, really want it to become a single-seller system so that eventually everyone, very much like in Washington, D.C. and in Vermont, where the law says that if you want to purchase health insurance or coverage, you have to do it through the exchange. And they needed to have enough people in there to keep it financially viable, so they said, that's our solution. We'll just force everybody in. I think that that is where the Obama administration intends to go. That's where all their money is going. That's where all their time is going, is to building this electronic network, this apparatus called the Health Insurance Exchange, which, as I said, doesn't sell insurance, And which is this huge network, this huge data gathering network, this huge system of monitoring your insurance status and of doling out subsidies and of putting you in Medicaid and of imposing the penalty. It's this big apparatus that they intend to have to install permanently in this country so that eventually that will be the only place that we will be able to buy coverage. And then we will have not a single payer system, but a single seller system. And then it will be all under the government, all under Obamacare, all under federal law. Because even today, the state exchanges, like here in Minnesota, the state exchange is required by state law to implement the federal law. This is all a federal exchange, I mean, a national exchange. It's all the federal government.
So it basically let's establish a toehold. You know, it's like the invasion of Normandy. You know, we just need to get on the beach at Omaha, you know, and get in a couple of miles and get a foothold on the continent of Europe, and then we can push forward inexorably right. towards our goal.
Right.
Okay. Well, look, once again, devil's advocate. You know, a lot of people would say, look at Scandinavia, look at Germany. These are countries that have essentially socialized medicine. They've had it, since the early 20th century. We're lagging behind because we're not in step with the rest of the world. And we really need a smooth, efficient system that, you know, let's make it a single-payer system, government-administered, equitable, and that'll take care of the problem. So what's the big deal? What's everybody screaming about? Why are the Republicans being so obstructionist?
Well, I guess I would say two things. We have a country unlike any other country in the world in that we actually have a constitution that puts the freedom of individuals on top and says that this is, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have a constitution that says that. I'm sorry, we have a declaration that says that, and then we have the constitution that formalizes it and says that the federal government cannot overreach and that anything that is not in the Constitution is not something that the federal government can do, and those powers are reserved for the states and for the individual citizens. So we have a different kind of country here that values the individual's freedom over efficiency, over centralization, over, you know, big systems. And it was all about protecting the individual from the overreach of federal government or the overreach of government officials into the individual's lives, controlling them, you know, taking their money for what the government deems the right thing and, you know, leaving them to suffer the consequences. When you look at Canada, when you look at Germany, when you look at England, you mentioned NICE, right, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. Lovely name, but NICE decided, for instance, that you had to lose your vision in one eye before they would treat the other eye, right? You know, in Canada, there is an institution called Medical Alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm missing a word in there, Medical Something Alternatives.
Yeah.
And it's for Canadians who can't get access to care, can't get surgery, can't get a CT scan for months,
yeah.
even to find out if they've got cancer. Right. And then once they know they've got cancer, even to get it treated. And they can come down to America or elsewhere around the world to get the treatment.
They can outsource it. Yeah, it's sort of medical tourism. It's interesting that somebody just pointed out that the town of Bellingham, Washington, is right across the border from Canada, from Vancouver and British Columbia. And that town... that small town of population, I don't know, 40,000, 50,000, has more MRI machines in this town than in the entire province of British Columbia because
yeah.
of all the Canadians who, hey, they're affluent Canadians and they have discretionary Canadian dollars and they can come across the border and they can say, why should I wait in a rationing system for 6 months to get my MRI if I've got a terrible shoulder problem and I want to find out if I need rotator cuff surgery? But it, you know, the system there deems it unnecessary for the vast majority of Canadian citizens overall to get MRIs at the drop of a hat. Okay, that's it.
Right. And so there you are as people whose very lives are endangered. There have been movies about people talking to people who have been on the waiting list. And by the end of the movie, you know, it took a while to produce the whole movie. And then by the time it's actually produced and we are looking at it, then what we see is a majority of those people have died because they never did get access to care and they didn't have the funds to cross the border. And so this is not how healthcare should be, but this is how, when I say coverage is not care, all the Canadians are covered. But that has not given them access to care, and certainly not timely access to care. And that is what that company is called, Timely Medical Alternatives. And it's just for Canadians to get them timely access to save their lives.
Okay. So in conclusion, what can people do? What's the call to action here? We have CCHF, or CC, is it CCHF? Yes, CCHF, citizensforhealthfreedom.org. And tell us about that organization, how people can get involved.
Sure. Actually, the URL is cchfreedom.org, and they can come to that page, cchfreedom.org. They can come to that page, and they can get involved several ways. One, they can get our weekly publication so they know what's going on and how they can take action. It comes out every Wednesday, and they can just click at the top of the homepage to get subscribed to that. Two, they can engage in our Refuse to Enroll campaign, which is that they refuse to enroll in the exchanges, because if the exchanges do not get enough enrollees, the exchanges will fail, and that means Obamacare will fail until, or be stalled, actually, until we get another president who will repeal the law. So, you know, we have a one
so business. So they won't haul you off to jail in a paddy wagon if you don't.
It's so important. I have had reporters ask me this. They say, you're telling people to break the law.
Yeah, right.
You don't know what the law is. You can, there are three ways to abide by the law.
Right.
One of them is to purchase insurance, or you get coverage through the exchange, government coverage through the exchange.
Right.
The second way is to pay the tax penalty for choosing not to get covered.
Right.
And the third way is to be one of the 9 exemptions. And those 9 exemptions are right on our homepage.
Okay.
So, you know,
that doesn't mean you're riding bareback, you don't have health insurance. It just means you're not choosing to engage with the machinery of federal bureaucracy.
Right. You can find a policy outside. You can choose to be uninsured if you wish, because it will be likely way less expensive for you than a policy, especially if you're young and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those are your choices. You can get insurance outside the exchange. You can go into the private exchanges that businesses and insurance companies are creating, you know, and forgo the government exchange. You know, don't help the apparatus to be installed permanently in this country.
Okay, it's almost like the sit-ins. It's like nonviolent resistance.
Right.
You don't have to, you know, carry pitchforks and torches to the Capitol steps to have your voice heard. Okay, so
we have a one pager to tell people the 4 big reasons not to do it, and outside of the fact that, you know, just stalling the exchange. But then we also have 6 action items on there, including telling your employer, don't dump us into the exchange.
Okay, so it's CCHFreedom.org, and I want to thank you very much, Twyla Braze, for bringing us up to date, and we'll rely upon you for some timely updates as this, I'm sure this story is going to continue with a lot of different ramifications until Election Day 2014 and beyond.
That's correct. Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks very much for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.